So again, for today's EPA Community Involvement University Presents Superfund Success, Tools and Techniques for Community Involvement Train the Trainer webinar, I'm going to pull up the presentation materials and turn things over to your very first presenter, Tina Conley. Tina?
Thank you, Jean. Hello, everyone, and again, welcome to the second offering of Superfund Success, Tools and Techniques for Community Involvement Train the Trainer webinar. My name is Tina Conley with EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, Community Involvement and Program Initiatives Branch. And I will be going through the webinar's rule of engagement, introducing our dynamic training team, and giving you some background information on how we got to our learning objectives, as well as an overview of today's agenda. In some regions, participants are coming together in conference rooms. Now I want to just tell you a little bit of who's in our virtual classroom. We have community involvement coordinators from across the country. I think we have almost every region covered. We have a community engagement specialist, community involvement managers, a team lead, remedial project managers, and an on-scene coordinator. So everyone, welcome. We have designed today's interactive webinar to encourage full participation and learning. Please minimize distractions, whatever those might be for you, and get ready to fully participate. Very importantly, the trainers will be asking you questions, conducting exercises of various types, and you will even be asked to get up off your seat. So keep engaged and actively learning throughout this webinar. So it's time to turn away your distractions and get ready to engage and learn. Now I would like to introduce to you the dynamic training team of instructors. We have Julie Congdon and Laura Knudsen, both community involvement coordinators in Region 10, and Pam Avery, an EPA training consultant and trainer. Since 2013, Julie Congdon has led the Region 10 community involvement team as the lead community involvement coordinator. She also is the community involvement coordinator, or CIC, as many of you know that term, for the Duwamish Superfund site. She has been with EPA for over 10 years and started out in assisting regulated communities with stormwater compliance. Our dynamic, Laura Knudsen will be joining her as our team community involvement coordinator as well. And Laura Knudsen has worked for EPA since 2010 and started at headquarters in the Superfund Community Involvement Program, where she led the 2016 update to the Community Involvement Handbook. While at headquarters, Laura also supported the Superfund Construction and Post-Construction Management Branch. Laura is currently the lead EPA Region 10 Community Involvement Coordinator at the Portland Harbor Superfund site. Our third instructor joining our team is Pamela, or Pam Avery. Pam is a specialist in communication strategies and crisis communications. Pam Avery has been a spokesperson trainer with the US EPA since 1998 and a neutral facilitator for the past decade. She has helped produce three documentary-style videos for EPA, most recently a video highlighting the conflict resolution processes in play in Silver Valley, Idaho, home to one of the largest Superfund sites in the United States. So earlier I identified who's participating on today's webinar, and almost everyone does Superfund community involvement work across the nation. The webinar was designed with a train-the-trainer framework, as you will see throughout the webinar, but it also is coupled with an opportunity for our remedial project managers, and also called RPMs, our on-scene coordinators, also referred to as OSCs, and others working on Superfund sites to learn more about Superfund community involvement resources, tools, and techniques that they can use and support the important work that they do in Superfund communities. These learning objectives have grown and have led us to today's webinar agenda. We are continuing to always talk about our training and improve as we go along. So after this introduction, Julie Congdon and Laura Knudsen will teach us about community involvement fundamentals in Module 1 and the specifics of community involvement tools, techniques, and available resources in Module 2. In Module 3, Pam Avery will give you presentation tips as well as tips on how to deal with certain situations that involve conflict and or anger, coping with stress, and how to listen effectively. After the three modules, we will go into the Ask the Experts panel session, which is a Q&A module that I mentioned earlier, that you will have the opportunity to ask the expert panel questions. It's a unique opportunity to have some one-on-one conversations with our great training team. Now I will turn it over to Julie Congdon.
Okay. Hello, everyone. Great to see you on the webinar today. So before we begin, we would like to ask you a question, and that is, when you think of community engagement or community involvement, what do you think of? And Jean, this is when folks can write in a one word or maybe just a quick phrase of what you like. Do you want to describe that, Jean?
I would love to. Okay, so ladies and gentlemen, this is going to be one of your first do's here in the session. There's going to be a box that's going to appear in the top part of your screen. So if you're not near the keyboard in the conference room, now is the time. And what I will encourage everybody to do is to type in those words, images, phrases, emotions that appear to you when you think about community engagement. So you can type it into the lower box and then hit the enter key or the send button. And you can type in as many as you like. And you're going to start to see a picture developing on the screen of those words. And it's a pretty cool interactive picture because as you each start typing in messages, the more commonly the messages or words appear across what you've entered, the bigger and bolder they're going to be. So we should start to see some trends pop up here. Oh, like chocolate. Chocolate seems to be a popular phrase there. We talk about community engagement. But I'm starting to see some other words. Again, what do you think of when community engagement comes to mind? And again, any words, there's no wrong answer here. So Laura and Julie, what do you see there?
Yes, we see chocolate coming through, which you know, I can give that a hearty recommendation that you're going to have a meeting. If you can, you know, I know we can't provide food, but, you know, I will sometimes come with a bag of chocolates, Dove chocolates or M&Ms, because that can really help break the ice and make things go so much more nicely and smoothly when you have meetings. So be it in the EPA office with your site team or with folks that you're meeting with at a community meeting. So.
And we say listening is a big one, trust, communication, collaboration. You know, all of those are excellent, obviously, for community engagement and one of the reasons why we do it and why it's in the Superfund law.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Okay. Let's see if the audience has anything else here. And if not, we'll go ahead and exit out of this particular arrangement here. Bear with me, guys.
That's okay.
And I want to thank the audience for playing along with that. And we'll go ahead and go back to the presentation materials. Now that we have a bit of a sense of what the audience thinks of when we're talking about community engagement.
Great. Well, I would definitely say that a lot of the words that were shown in there really resonate with those key things that you need to be thinking about when you consider engaging with the community. Obviously, at the top of the list, you know, is being inclusive, that you want to make sure that you're identifying and inviting and including all interested stakeholders, all interested parties to the cleanup. And being open and transparent, it really promotes the trust, which you really do want to cultivate and engender with the community, and being available, accessible, and quick to respond to folks' questions and concerns is really critical too. It really helps to anticipate and respond what those concerns might be, what their fears are, what their points of confusion might be, just so that you can be ready for that when you are meeting with them and you're talking with them, and to know what those issues might be. Promoting open and frequent two-way communication and practicing active listening with the community is very critical as well. Empathizing with community members and other stakeholders, just think of like how you would want to be treated if you were suddenly confronted with being told that you are living near a Superfund site. So it really is important to treat people with courtesy and respect, just understanding that they may have concerns or questions about what that means to be near a Superfund site. And then tailoring your community involvement approaches and activities to meet community needs. You know, some of this goes to speaking plainly, and there's some really great resources available on plainlanguage.gov, but it's making sure that what you're doing is accessible to them. So you know, as we preface this training today, I know it's for community involvement, train the trainer, and so some of you as seasoned CICs will be training new CICs as they come on. But in looking at the roster, I know we've got some RPMs and some OSCs in the room today, which is great. It's really, you are a part, you're a critical part of a site team when we're working on Superfund sites. It's not just the CIC doing this, but, you know, RPMs and OSCs do this work as well. And I think what you can learn in the training today really harkens to that, which you can learn when you're working with the community. So today, when we're talking about community involvement and Superfund, we'll go over why it's important to involve the community. What does community involvement mean? And at what point in the removal process, as well as the remedial process, when do you begin engaging with the community? What is the role of community members in Superfund cleanups, but also what is the role of EPA representatives with work in Superfund cleanup and community involvement? And as we go through the slides, you may notice that we use public and community somewhat interchangeably in the presentation, and that's because while public is a good overall term, community, or really more specifically communities, gets more at the diversity that you'll encounter at your sites. And while you're generally working with the public, there may be different communities with different interests or needs that you must work with. So, why do we involve the community? Well, number one, it's the law. We are legally required to do so. It states that in CERCLA. It also is EPA policy, which does recommend that we do kind of go above and beyond what we may just do just for like a public meeting when a proposed plan comes out. There's often a lot of other activities that we do that go above and beyond what's required in the national contingency plan. Also, it's efficient. You'll find that you'll get a lot more community buy-in if you are working with affected communities early. It can increase that community acceptance, which is one of those 9 criteria that we have when we're looking at the appropriate remedy for a site. Also, when you're talking with the community, it can supplement the knowledge that we may have about a site. There may be certain ways that the community uses an area or what the history is there that can really give you better insight about a cleanup or what historic uses may have been there. And it can also enable better decisions that are more long-lasting and, again, getting to the community acceptance that people will, you'll have more community buy-in that way. So additionally, in involving the community, it can increase the community knowledge and understanding about why EPA is there, about, you know, how the contamination came to be, what the human health risk is, you know, the kind of critical things that they need to know about what's going on with cleanup. And getting back to just the need to develop that trust, you really want that trust and credibility in working with the community, you know, to have them understand why we're doing the cleanup and, you know, getting their acceptance of it.
Which came up in the word cloud, everyone.
Exactly, yeah. And then also when you're working with the community, that's where you start building that dialogue. When disagreements or confusion or misunderstandings come up, if you have that trust and credibility there, you're going to be able to have that dialogue with them to resolve any of that confusion. And then also getting back to community acceptance. If you're able to resolve those disagreements, if you've been able to build up that trust and credibility with the community, it's really going to go a long way in having that stronger cleanup. So what is community involvement? Well, it can begin when you're talking with a community member on the phone. They call you up, they have a question. That's community involvement right there, just one-on-one, straight-up talking, community engagement. Also, it can be when you are at a community event, and it can also be when you're partnering with another public agency. In this picture shown here, this is at the Duwamish River Festival, and we were partnering with Public Health Seattle King County to do outreach to community folks about safe fish consumption from the Duwamish. So that's a really easy way. It's very family friendly to engage with folks just in a very easygoing sense. Community involvement can also be when you are doing informal coffee chats in the community. Again, it's important to go where they are. You can't expect them to be coming to your offices downtown, someplace that's maybe not in anywhere near their site. It's really important to get out to where they are and to do it at times that's easy for them. And in those kind of situations where it's not an intimidating like public meeting, that it's just more informal and easygoing to be able to talk with you. But in thinking of public meetings, community engagement is also, this is another example of kind of a more informal situation. It could be like on a boat tour. You're doing a walking tour of a Superfund site. Here, an RPM is talking with a community member about what's going on the Duwamish River cleanup site. But as I was saying about formal meetings, that can be a time to engage with the community too, talking to stakeholders at a biannual presentation of what's going on with the cleanup. But really overall, community involvement is that process of when you are engaging in a dialogue and a collaboration with communities at your affected Superfund sites. So what are the objectives of Superfund community involvement? Well, number one, it's keeping them well informed. And so you know, it's important that we demonstrate to community members that they are involved in the decision-making process. Most of the communities, those that appear maybe unconcerned, it is important to know that they do want to be informed of EPA's activities, even when there appears to maybe there's nothing going on at the site. And this harkens back to being open and transparent, as well as being available, accessible, and quick to respond. Also, number two, encouraging and enabling the public to get involved. This goes back to being inclusive. And it's where people should be able to talk to an OSC or an RPM or other members of the Superfund site team at different times, you know, be it a teleconference call or different meetings, but being able to get in touch with the team to get their questions answered about what's going on at a site. Number three, listening carefully to what the public is saying. Again, this gets back to empathizing with community members. You know, that having the long-term success of a project is really enhanced by involving the public early and often. And as you're considering the public's concerns throughout the process, it can lead to better decision making. So it's really good to have that active listening going on and you know, not listening to be knowing what you're going to be saying next, like, okay, I think another question, I'm going to answer it. No. It's sometimes you have to take a step back, fully absorb what they're saying and realize, okay, I thought that they were asking a question about that. Actually, their concern is really getting to this other issue, and that's maybe the bigger thing that you need to address. Number four, dealing responsibly with public concerns. This is where it's important to be tailoring your community involvement approach and activities to really to those community needs that they have. And incorporating those concerns that have been expressed by communities about a site shouldn't be a cause for delay or excessive cost, but as you give the necessary time and resources to community involvement, that's where it should help you to be able to successfully address those concerns in site decisions. Okay. So going on with objectives of Superfund community involvement, so when appropriate, addressing the public concerns, this gets back again to being available, accessible, and quick to respond. And it's really important that we be able to be flexible and willing to alter plans when a community presents valid concerns. And there have been times in recent years where EPA has demonstrated an increased willingness to change and or significantly alter its preferred remedy in the face of valid community concerns. And you know, even though we may remain unpersuaded after hearing from the public, it is our responsibility to seriously consider suggestions and give feedback to communities about the comments that we've received and that we carefully and thoughtfully considered those. And those are things that you can outline in your responsiveness summary to like proposed plan. Number six, communicating with community members about how concerns are addressed. And so regardless of how what the outcome of a site decision is, it's really important to communicate to them about how we came to that. They may not like the decision, but at least if they can understand it, there may be a little more acceptance around that. And this gets back to promoting that open and frequent two-way communication with the community and practice the active listening with the community. But it also gets to being available, accessible, and quick to respond to the concerns that may come up. And then 7, taking environmental justice concerns into account. And this is getting to being sensitive and understanding about what concerns they may have. And so if you are conducting community involvement activities comprehensively, environmental justice concerns will be met. But it is important to recognize the unique concerns that are faced by environmental justice communities. So what is environmental justice? Well, as it's stated through the, I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the different, the law or the policy that's behind this, but what it does state is that it's the fair treatment and meaningful involvement of all people, regardless of race, color, national origin, or income, with respect to the development, implementation, and enforcement of environmental laws, policy, regulations, and policies.
Yeah, and Monica just popped in there. It's Executive Order 12898.
Thank you.
1994. Thanks, Monica.
Thank you. So considering where many Superfund sites are, it's nearly inevitable that they are in communities with environmental justice characteristics. And the reason why I say environmental justice characteristics is that some communities may be sensitive to being labeled in environmental justice communities. Even though they may have all the characteristics of one, they may not want to be called an EJ community. They don't see themselves as that, even though they are typified by that. So as I refer to this, it's environmental justice, communities with environmental justice characteristics. So tips on how to work in communities like that, and we'll have more to say about this later in Laura's slides. But learning about the history of community, people obviously have a very deep connection to the neighborhoods they live in, and there's a lot to learn about why it became the way it was, that maybe, you know, it used to be a community of very small farms, and then it became industrial, and how do they maybe still hold on to some links to that past history. It's also important to ensure that the community understands their rights, that they, you know, there are supposed to be public meetings, that there are certain parts that we are supposed to follow in CERCLA in involving the community. It's also an important language considerations that really allows for people to engage fully. In the case of the Duwamish, I believe it was the very first one that had ever been held in the U.S., a public meeting for Superfund that was held entirely in Spanish. So if there's something you can do to be opening up access to that, that's important. And one thing to know is that if you do need translation or interpretation services, you can take advantage of the Office of Civil Rights translation contract. So we'll be talking about that later. Additional considerations for communities with environmental justice characteristics, being visible in the community, just getting out there and getting to know folks, letting them see that you're there, that you're not afraid to come to their community, that, you know, there may be contamination there, but you're not scared to be there as well. And just getting out there and getting to know folks is important. Understanding how the community receives their information, they may not be getting it. They may not know. If you put up a flyer at a cafe, maybe that's one way they're, oh, great, there's going to be a community meeting in my neighborhood next week. I'm going to go to that. But maybe that's not how they get it. They hear about it, you know, through Nextdoor, or they hear about it, you know, talking to their neighbor who received a postcard. You know, it's important to figure out how they, you know, if it's word of mouth or other ways that they find out how they get information about the Superfund site. And then also it's important to take family needs into consideration. When you're scheduling a meeting, do you do it during the daytime? A lot of folks might not be able to come because they're working, but also if you do it in the evening, they may have children with them. So if there's some way that you can arrange to have childcare, I know for the Duwamish, we've partnered with the CAG who they are able to provide that service. So if you can do something, you know, or somehow make the event a little more family friendly, that can really help to make it more accommodating for folks in the community. Okay, so continuing on, what are environmental justice concerns? What would be some of the things that you see at sites? And it's really the disproportionate burden or exposure of environmental health effects on the communities that are there. And it may not be just exposure to the health risks that are there at the Superfund site, but it's really those cumulative health impacts that they can have. You know, if they're eating fish from a contaminated site, maybe that's, you know, in the case of the Duwamish, that's how the primary way they get exposure to contamination is by eating contaminated fish. But folks in the Duwamish Valley have a very heavy burden of air pollution, and they have higher asthma rates. So it's not just one thing, but it's multiple things that can be affecting them. And it's also the unique exposure scenarios that people may have in how they are exposed to contamination. So that's another thing that is important to find out of how people are interacting with the site, or how, what are the pathways of how they get exposed. And then also the experience or perception the community has. You may think that you're being open and inclusive to them. You're like, well, but I advertised this, you know, in the, you know, community newspaper, you know, but if they aren't able to necessarily participate because the meeting's not held at a time that works for them, or there isn't translation there, they may feel that they don't have equal access to the decision-making process as somebody who is a native English speaker or has the disposable time to be able to go to that. So it really is important to think about, does the community feel that they do have access to participate in the decision-making that we're doing? So,
Elizabeth, we see your question. I'm going to be covering that in my module, so we'll come back to that civil rights, Office of Civil Rights piece, so don't worry about that.
Okay. So when do we begin engaging with communities? And this is one point. We can take a pause here. I heartily recommend that you download this and you print it up on 11 by 17 tabloid size paper. I have this hanging in my cubicle because, hey, I even as a CIC, I sometimes don't always remember what are the required steps for certain parts in the removal process. And on the next page, it's the remedial process. So above, you'll see what's required, but below, it shows what's recommended to go above and beyond for those communities that maybe need, you know, extra engagement to make sure that they are able to participate fully in the Superfund process. Okay, moving on. We also have a slide here that shows the public involvement spectrum. And, you know, I'm not going to go thoroughly through this, but this is just basically to give, kind of show you where things kind of lie. A lot of EPA's work falls in the yellow and the green categories, where it's kind of just a unilateral, we're just giving information to people, but not necessarily fully actively engaging them in the process. But you will find in working with communities, they're going to want to get you on the purple end of the spectrum. They really want much more ownership over the decision. And so a lot of the work we do, a lot of times it's managing expectations. We will want to try to involve folks as much as we can, and, you know, involving them as much in the decision-making process, but really the authority always rests with EPA. We cannot abdicate that. The only time that we would, you know, if they apply for, say, an environmental workforce and development job training grant, that's where they have ownership over it. That's the purple end of the spectrum. But really, a lot of our work is going to be the yellow through the blue. So just to be aware of that and how you may be having to manage expectations for communities that you work with. So talking now about the role of EPA in community involvement, well, it depends on who's involved. And, you know, more often than not, a lot of the work for community involvement will fall to the CIC. But, you know, we are members of the site team, so it really kind of, you know, in that sense, takes a village, it takes a team. So, you know, we will be the ones kind of coming up, you know, with the plans and with a lot of the activities, but it really is critical to be working with the RPM or the OSC. In the photos here, you'll see in the middle, I'm standing with two RPMs when we were at an event to celebrate community health advocates and their graduation and being trained about doing safe fish consumption outreach. So, but it's really, you know, it's not just me there, but they're there too, and, you know, it's so that those community health advocates can get to know those faces, that they're going to see them out in the community, that these are folks to go to learn more about what the technical side or what's going on with the cleanup. Down below, you also see Eva DiMaria, who is engaging with a community member at the public at a public forum for the Portland Harbor Superfund cleanup. And, you know, it's great for RPMs to be there to hear directly, not through the CIC, who may be an intermediary to communicate the questions from the community, but to hear it directly themselves of the concerns the communities may have or the interests that they have. Here we also see Laura in action at a similar public forum answering questions that folks have. But also, not her supervisor, but Eva's supervisor is the branch chief, or not the branch chief, sorry, section chief? Is David, David Chen, right?
David Zen,
Who he was there too at the public forum, so he too gets to see it, and so he is able to understand what the site team, what are some of the issues that the community is facing, and so that he understands what are the questions that the RPM is getting and the CIC is getting. So really kind of having that whole integrated support is important. And headquarters has a role too, and we really appreciate the support that headquarters is able to give us for doing work with the communities. And we'll get more into that technical support that headquarters can provide later on. Okay, so what are required community engagement actions? Well, you'll want to look back to that that panoramic of the different activities of when you begin those for remedial removal.
Appendix A of the community involvement handbook.
Exactly, Appendix A, which is great. So, you know, some of the things you'll be doing is conducting community interviews, and that's where you're getting information of how do people want to be engaged, which folds into a community involvement plan. And so this is a great opportunity for us to ask you a question, a quiz question, and that is, do you folks know if, does the NCP require you to develop a CIP, a community involvement plan for a removal action that lasts less than 6 months? Yes or no?
Seems to me
I had Jeopardy.
In. Don't cheat. Don't look at the CI handbook. Don't look at those chairs.
So remember, you'll see a question in the bottom left corner. All you can do is click the circle, yes or no, next to the answer that you think is correct. Now, we can see how you're voting, but you can't see how the others are voting. We'll wait a minute or two more here before we close it out. We check, so hurry, get those answers in. All right, let me go ahead and we'll lock it down here and we'll show the distribution. And the answer, ladies?
It is no, and a majority of you have that, so good job, people. All right, so right, and we'll get more in talking about communications plans in Laura's slides. Another thing you're going to need to do that's required is establishing an information repository, an administrative record. So that's basically the record storage area that you're going to have at or near a Superfund site. And that actually can vary in itself. You may have a library that you can have as your information repository. But it's good to contact the library of, well, how do they want that? And do you give them a CD or some other form of electronic access so that it's not volumes and volumes of binders and other technical documents and reports that they would have to house themselves?
Yeah, something we've explored at Pearl and Harbor, just to interject quickly, is the library system. We found the main library contact for the entire library system in Multnomah County, and they actually, you know, have a really good online system, so we do still, you know, put some hard copy documents in certain library branches, but we also have a link, you know, an online link, since everything is in SIMS now, or supposed to be, to our administrative record that actually, if someone searches on the library website, Portland Harbor, that electronic link to our administrative record would come up in the library system, and so that's you know, one way that we're dealing with that at Portland Harbor. Not every place obviously can do that, but it's an example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and some of it can vary too. I mean, if you're not in an urban area, you know, with like a, you know, a library system like that, if you're out in a rural area, it might be difficult to find a repository. And it may be hard too for people to have internet access. So just saying, oh, we're going to post it online and you can access the administrative record that way, or that'll be our information repository. Not always good enough. And so I think in one case for us, at one Superfund site that's out on a tribal reservation, they have used the tribal center as the location where they've used it as an information repository. So it's a great, you know, it's important to get to know your community and to find out what will work best for them, for where to find the information that you have housed about the site. Also, you are required to notify the community about technical assistance opportunities, and that would be, you know, if they want to retain a technical expert, and so that would be where they might be able to be eligible for a technical assistance grant, and we'll talk about more about the technical assistance opportunities in Laura's slides. And then also, you are required to provide public notice, receive public comments, and coordinate public meetings and respond to public comments at those different parts of the Superfund process when you're working with communities. Okay, and then moving on. What are some of our recommended community involvement actions? Well, meeting with local officials and opinion leaders, knowing who are kind of the movers and shakers as you identify them in the community, it can be important to meet with them, especially if, you know, folks are looking to them to get their information about things going on in the community. Also, you could prepare a risk communication strategy, kind of like a communications plan if you if it's something a little more short term. It's really just, you know, that process of informing folks about the hazards of a Superfund site, just so that they understand, you know, the kind of the assessment of the risk, how to manage the risk, you know, and helping them kind of develop a, I guess, more informed perception of what the risk is there. And then developing press releases and fact sheets is appropriate. These are tools, obviously, that are easy to reach a large audience quickly, tools that will help you publicize the site-related decision, an upcoming meeting, changes in the schedule of cleanup, or just changes in the activities that are going on at a site. And we will get more into other tools and techniques later in Laura's slides, which are next.
Thanks, Julie. So this is Laura Knudsen, and I'm going to break into module two here, community involvement tools and techniques. And so Julie just gave, you know, obviously a really great foundation that I think, you know, from looking at the roster, a lot of you are familiar with. So thank you, Julie. And now I'm going to go into, you know, specific tools and techniques that basically, you know, allow us to execute those fundamental core principles that Julie went over. And I just want to make a couple notes before I, you know, start. You know, this is, you know, a train the trainer session. And so, you know, ideally you could take, you know, some of what Julie had, you know, some of her slides. You don't have to present this entire thing, or if there's, you know, certain slides that you think would be helpful for your site team to present in, you know, my module or Julie's module or Pam's module, you know, you could take those and present them. So that's really what we're trying to do here. And in my section here, Julie and I have put in, there's some boxes that will pop up that say site team tips. And so those are specific things that we've kind of thought through that maybe as a community involvement coordinator, I know we do have, I think, an RPM and OSC listening in too, so you can kind of think about it from a different perspective. But, you know, there are some things that we've thought about that could be useful for site teams to consider, and if you're a CIC, to maybe bring those up with your site teams. And if you have, you know, the RPM and OSC who's on and anyone else and other CICs, if you have other site team tips you think that would be great, we'd love to have those too. And I just want to say, you know, from looking at the last thing is just looking at the questions that all of you answered in the, you know, when you signed up for this, I think this section will kind of get to, you know, some people said you wanted to stay updated on tools and techniques, get a better understanding of the overall process. I think Julie kind of went over that. And we will be, you know, hopping through this because I know one of the things that you said was innovative and new ideas or something that you'd like. And so I think a lot of you, you know, especially seasoned CICs on the phone and in the webinar already will know a lot of these. And so Pam's section, which is after this, please, you know, don't go away because I think you'll be very interested in that. She has some really great, innovative, new ideas for you to think about. So that being said, I'm going to just start by going over some just, you know, key steps for effective community involvement. I think, you know, many of you on the phone and in the webinar room know about this. But one quote by Benjamin Franklin I want to start with is, by failing to prepare, you are preparing to fail. And I think most of us are familiar with that. But that is why one of the first key steps that I'm going to go over, which kind of form the basis for the tools that I'm going to go into, is develop a strategy. So obviously that's incredibly important because even if your strategy changes, when you identify the community needs up front, you know, and you can customize the process going forward, and I think at pretty much every project I've been in that's had to happen, the strategy I came up with was not what always ended up being the final strategy. You know, and working with your site team on the strategy is important. Plan and budget for public involvement activities is an obvious one, but I think it can be a little bit tricky, you know, to manage sometimes, depending on what, you know, resources you have at your disposal too. And, you know, basically just this isn't just, you know, monetary planning. Like if you have contracts, obviously thinking about how you're going to use that and how you're going to use, you know, funding at your, if you have funding at your disposal. Sometimes I know a lot of teams don't have money for, you know, additional contract work, but also thinking about time, you know, planning for time, for your time, for review time, for your team's time, you know, thinking beyond just monetary budgeting and planning too is important. Identifying the interested and affected communities. So this is, we're going to go into the EJ Screen tool a little bit in this training, which Julie alluded to earlier, because that's an incredibly important piece, obviously, for this work. And consider providing technical or financial assistance. Julie covered that, you know, in some of her slides. We're going to be going over the tools that would that are at your disposal for that piece. And continuing on, we have a few other ones. So providing information and outreach to the public, and conducting public consultation and involvement activities. So, you know, this also would, you know, I also want to put in here, Julie, I talked about this piece, you know, tribal consultation is obviously a piece here too, which is, you know, which is very important if you have tribes at your site. You know, we have excellent tribal coordinators in the regions. And I know Julie and I both have tribal involvement at our site. We work with them. Our site teams work with them. And so we're pretty well versed here. But, you know, this might be something, you know, just as a CIC, you want to make sure is on the forefront of your team, your team's minds. And then also evaluating public involvement activities. So, you know, this one can be done, you know, we don't have as many tools, I would say, in this training for this, so just briefly going over a couple things, you know, you can informally assess an activity, you know, some different ways. You can call people after a meeting, obviously, get feedback from your site team. I periodically do debriefs with my team after a meeting to see internally how they thought it went, and then also call people, partners up who were at the meeting to see how it went, community members. You can do that informally. You also can do, you know, informal surveys, but you have to be a little careful about that because of something, you know, called the Paperwork Reduction Act, where you can't interview or provide, you know, questions to nine or more non-federal employees. And so we do have a resource that I believe Jean has in the website for this webinar training that is a list of pre-approved customer satisfaction survey questions that's part of a headquarters information collection request, which is something you need in order to do a survey. And you know, Tina and Leslie's group at headquarters, CIPIV, actually has one approved that they renew. And so you can actually, if you wanted to actually ask some specific questions written after a meeting, you could use some of the questions from that, and that's approved. You also can just ask general questions as well. You know, just open-ended, have a box. I do this at my meetings, you know, a comment, feedback, well, sorry, not comment, feedback box, if people have any feedback after the meeting, and we do get feedback from that. So just a quick, now we're going to go into some specific tools, but before we do that, we're going to start, you know, with the community involvement plan and communication strategy. So just a quick question, if you could type in, can you explain the difference between a CIP, community involvement plan, and a communication strategy? If you could type your answer into the box, we'll get a few. Okay, if a communication strategy is part of a CIP, it's a good answer. That's correct. For example, in Portland Harbor, we have a lot of community concern over PCB volatilization and the sediment that will be dredged up during the remedial action work. And so that's something that we're actually going to be putting in putting in a more, I guess, formal communication strategy in the CIP. A communication strategy can be informal. We have CIP is a more long-term and broad, communication strategy is more specific and short-term. Yep, that's totally right. You guys are great. Let me see some of the other ones that are coming in here. Communication strategy is an internal document. So yeah, that's true. It can be a component of a CIP, like I said, if you want to, you know, put certain pieces in for a specific issue.
But it can be FOIA'd, right?
It can be FOIA'd. We'll go over that, yeah. Let me see if there's a CIP is a formal document covering a scope of involvement, while the strategy is more for planning. Yeah, these are all good. So there's any more. We have four. Those are all great ones. Oop, got another one. Let's see, what's that one? Internal document, what's that one? Part of CIP, formal document, okay. All right, I think, communication strategy is more targeted to special messages. Okay, so I think that's pretty much, need to be put out. Okay, so a communication strategy is more targeted to special messages that need to be put out. A CIP is more comprehensive guidance for overall engagement. So I think, you know, all of those are great pieces. You know, if you have a specific issue at your site that's, you could consider putting some kind of communication, elements of a communication strategy into your CIP too. So I think we're going to move on now. Thanks for putting in your answers. All right, so let's just dive into this too. So two community involvement planning methods. So before we go into the CIP and communication strategies just a little more, which I know a lot of you are familiar with, I just want to go over these key planning method fundamentals that cover both documents. And I know these are obvious, but this is something Julie and I have both been in meetings where no one asks these questions. And these are really good questions to ask. They're not dumb questions. And if you ask them, you often can get multiple answers to these questions, which when you're trying to do a project plan, you're trying to do a communication strategy, you know, is not, you kind of need one answer sometimes. So let's see what the questions are. So, what are your goals and objectives? So that's a key one, right? This is just something that's really important. I've just been in site team meetings, and, you know, sometimes that's not asked. And it's really important to ask that question. Who do you need to reach? Audiences, obviously, you know, these are key questions, but over and over again, you know, they sometimes aren't asked, and then you can get far along in a project or a thought process, and it can be hard to change direction. And then what do they need to know? You know, messages, what do you want your audience to do? So those are action items. I think a lot of times I've seen, and Julie's seen, you know, that people jump right to that one. You know, jumping right to action before asking these other really critical questions. And that's why, you know, strategy and community involvement plan are very important documents, and that you can help, you know, justify that to a site team as well. And then how are you going to reach them, you know, outreach approaches and materials. So community involvement plans. So, you know, just quickly going over this, you know, this is a slide. If, you know, your site team isn't familiar with the community involvement plan, you could go over this. It's a roadmap for community involvement throughout the cleanup process. So I think it's important, you know, if you're revising a community involvement plan after the ROD is released, which is, you know, or, you know, after the proposed plan piece, which is part of the NCP that you have, you know, EPA should be reviewing that, or you're writing it for the first time, that's, you know, important to just clarify what is it to people. It's a community-oriented document, so, you know, we have some good tools that are at, you know, our disposal. There's a great webinar done on plain language writing, and that's exactly what you want it to be. You don't want it to be written at a really, really high, high level with a lot of technical jargon in there. It needs to be written in plain language, and that's really important. And community interviews, obviously, are critical. Like that, you know, at the Portland Harbor Superfund site, for instance, you know, it was a way to build relationships after there was a lot of anxiety some, you know, concern in the community after the ROD was released that, you know, EPA maybe hadn't been quite as present during some of that time. And so, you know, using the community interviews as part of the community involvement plan update was critical for the Portland Harbor relationship building with the community. I think that's true in other sites, too. It is a living document, so, you know, like I mentioned, after, you know, there you can update it at different times. It does, depending on your site, it can take, you know, some effort to do that. So the NCP obviously does say, as we all know, you know, that, you know, you have one when the site's listed, you're developing one, and then you can, you know, definitely there's a check-in after the proposed plan ROD time period to update it again. And I do just want to mention, you know, there's in the website that that Jean, you know, has for this webinar that she mentioned in the beginning, there are examples of community involvement plans that are award winners. So there's one from 2018. It's the community involvement plan for the Lower Passaic River, which is a great one. There's also the Grass River Community Involvement Plan and the Coeur d'Alene Basin Cleanup Plan that won in 2015. And I just want to mention, you know, the Grass River CIP is 52 pages long. The Coeur d'Alene one is 16 pages long. And they're both excellent community involvement plans. It's, you know, not necessarily about the length of the community involvement plan, you know, that matters. They're both great, and they both needed to be the lengths they were for different reasons. That's just something to consider, too. So components of a CIP, so as we know, you know, the CIP does describe the site, includes a community profile, identifies community needs and concerns, and specifies EPA's action plan. The community profile, I just want to mention that that's also a tool in the community involvement toolkit, which there is a link to that, again, in the website that Jean mentioned for this webinar as well. And then it also allows for community comment, and I just want to mention, you know, I like to say community feedback just because there actually isn't a requirement specifically for public comment on the community involvement plan. You know, we're not required to take comment, but we know, you know, and those seasoned CICs on the phone know that that's a really good thing to do, is to take community feedback on the CIP. It was, you know, generated from interviewing the community. You can also, you know, interview other, you know, key stakeholders or partners or tribal members in the community as well. For Portland Harbor, I was able to interview some contacts, you know, with the Yakima Nation and the Grand Ronde, and also, you know, representatives from the city of Portland who we partner closely with. You know, the Port of Portland is really interested. They happen to be PRPs, but they're also public agencies who are interested, so we interviewed them. I know Julie did that for the Duwamish Community Involvement Plan, too. So anyway, you know, those entities also are definitely, I know, going to be providing feedback on the community involvement plan as well, even though, you know, we focused on community leaders and members. And so there is a great community involvement plan tool in the toolkit that has more information on all of this, too. So, you know, quickly, CIP, obviously, build and maintain relationships is critical if you're trying to, you know, justify why are you doing all these interviews, you know, to your site team. That's a key one that can't be understated. Think of it, you know, as an invitation, as I said. Again, those relationships, critical, community, you know, leader, community member relationships, but also others, other partners. And, you know, make the CIP available and request feedback or comments, if you want to call it comments. I'm just sensitive to comments since it's not, like, you know, specific, you know, under the NCP. And then there is a great, I was mentioning that plain writing piece, so there's a great webinar that's listed right here, Effective Writing for Superfund Staff, Community Involvement Plans, and Beyond. And I think Jean has that linked in the website again for this webinar, so you can access that, and I highly recommend it. So just a couple site team tips. So again, you know, I mentioned revisiting the CIP at major milestones is a good thing to do. But managing internal expectations is a key site team tip. So, you know, I know Julie mentioned, you know, we talked about this for Duwamish, there were some things, you know, that were very aspirational initially in the CIP that, you know, she really wanted to do or really wanted to put in based on all the great feedback she'd received from her community interviews. But after ground-truthing some of that with the site team and her RPMs, you know, because she involved them early on, you know, before her first draft was even developed, that changed a little bit. Some of that language changed a little bit, and so managing those internal expectations with your team is important, whether you're doing it for the first time or whether you're doing it as a revision. And then managing expectations for involvement post record of decision is important too. And, you know, that's something that's challenging for the Portland Harbor Superfund site, because obviously once you're post rod, they're really, you know, other than there is, you know, a 30-day public comment period for consent decrees before remedial action. But other than that, you know, there's not really any formal public comment period that is required by the NCP unless there's a ROD amendment. And so just really being clear in the CIP, you know, as we're doing the update for Portland Harbor, that's something we're struggling with on what the expectations are, you know, and we're thinking about putting in, you know, something about at a certain point in the design process, you know, we're going to, you know, make sure that the community, there's a check-in and, you know, some feedback will be gathered, but, you know, it's not a formal public comment process. That's not the thing, and clarifying that is important. And I know Duwamish has outlined that as well, and I'm sure some of you have for your community involvement plans. So, communication strategies. So I think everyone got this very clearly in the exercise we did. It is, you know, a single event or a short-term project. So I gave the, you know, PCB volatilization example for Portland Harbor that is a challenge for us. Addresses a specific problem or issue, and, you know, can be, as I said, a component of a CIP, but not necessarily. This is just a little example. You know, there is a communication strategy tool in the toolkit. This is just a little snapshot of a communication strategy that I started to develop for the quarterly public forums for Portland Harbor, because we do a lot of outreach to different groups, and we need communication strategies for that. So just a little example of how I do it. You can do it in Excel, do it however you like. So questions to ask when developing a community involvement strategy. So I think we're going to start with a question here, just an open-ended question, but you can type it into the Q&A pod. I think, Jean, that's what we're planning, right?
That is correct.
Great. So what do you do when you're developing your CI strategy? So if you could type that, your answer, into the Q&A pod, that would be great. We can just see some of those.
And remember, that Q&A window is in the lower right corner. You can click on the empty box and type the message on in, and then we'll browse through some of those comments as they're coming in. And if you haven't figured it out, I'm filling in dead air time while you all are busy typing in your messages on your computer. So we want to be sure that you guys have time to put in a thoughtful response. Even if it's just a few words, the instructors and I will kind of read through them and offer those suggestions or thoughts to the rest of the audience. If you happen to have gotten distracted by emails emails, or perhaps somebody popped over your cubicle wall and wanted to chat with you, we just want to remind you to click back on over to the webinar and be part of this question. And so I think I'm starting to see some of those comments or questions to come in. Laura, do you see any in the window?
So I see one. Monica is on it, and she is saying that one of the things that she does when she's developing community involvement strategies is how do you prefer to receive information, and how often? So thank you. That's good. We don't really need to spend too much more time on this. That's a good one. Thank you, Monica. So, first, what is the specific issue to which EPA is responding? So, those principal pieces that I went over in the very beginning on, what is the goal, what is the message, those are really good things to, hash out in the community involvement strategy, too. And what information do we need to communicate? And that's getting into Monica's piece, how do you prefer to receive information, how often, who is involved, affected, or interested. So those are key pieces, and some of that, who is involved, affected, interested, EJ screen can help with that piece. Are there traditionally underrepresented groups that need to be reached? Again, EJ screen can help a lot with that, and we'll talk about that in a moment. What information does each stakeholder already have? What information does each stakeholder need? What is the concern of each stakeholder? And how will site team members communicate with stakeholders? And the one thing I want to just mention on this slide is stakeholder is a term that's commonly used. I would say, if you have a site where there are tribes involved with the site, in my experience, they, tribe members often don't like to be called stakeholders, in my experience. And so, stakeholders and tribal members would be, just something that I would recommend saying or considering to say. If you have tribes at your site. So some tips for communication strategies, again, always prefer strategy, going back to that Ben Franklin quote, include target dates and milestones. That little Excel that I put together, has that really is an internal document. I'm not putting that in the community involvement plan. And it can change. That's something like we talked about in the beginning. Working with others to develop and implement the strategy is important. And refining it based on community feedback and also, internal feedback. And, keeping that goal in mind, which can be really difficult when, there are multiple interests, working on a certain project. Keeping that goal in mind, that's why it's the first question that you ask. And that's why it was, we went over that in the very beginning of this module, because that's key. You got to stick to that goal. Keep on coming back to it. And keep in mind, communication strategies, like Julie was mentioning earlier, they are subject to the Freedom of Information Act requests. So that's why, if they're internal, just be cognizant of that. Always, think that it can be, could get out to the public. So we're going to go over some additional tools now, and this is where I'm going to talk about the Office of Civil Rights contracts, just so you know. I think Elizabeth had that question earlier. So just a quick open-ended question, too. Also, this goes in the Q&A pod. So what are some outreach materials or techniques that you have used or would like to use at your site? So I just like, before I go over some of the specific tools that I and Julie have, thought about, I just wanted to ask that question. So do you have anything that you'd like to share, some maybe innovative outreach materials? I'd love to see that in the Q&A box. I'll give everyone a moment.
And so, Laura, while we're waiting for some of those examples to come in, I think you were kind of hitting back on that idea for those people who had indicated on their registration that they wanted some specific tools. You guys are going to start listing some specific tools, so this might be a time for some people to kind of tune in closely to some of the tools that are available.
Yeah, so I'm going to go ahead, if you can, as I'm going through some of these initial tools, thank you, Jean, feel free to go ahead and type them into the box and Q&A box, and I will highlight those as well. Oh, great. So Kathleen, thank you. Mass notification system, that's good. We should probably, get it. I don't use that. Do you use that for Duwamish?
I guess I'm wondering what mass notification system means. Does that mean like the old gov delivery? Like, are you sending out, like, do you have a listserv or?
Yeah. Yeah, Kathleen, if you have any other information about that. Yeah, Jean?
Yeah, it's probably similar to the one that they've started implementing here at headquarters. So we have a mass notification system where staff will receive both email and text messages to email or phone numbers that they register whenever there's an emergency issue in the headquarters area. And so you sort of subscribe and decide how you want to be notified. And it can come in as a user subscribed email or text message.
Great. Thank you. Yeah, so Kathleen, thanks for clarifying, too, a robo-text system. So Kathleen uses that at her and some of her site work. Monica was mentioning fact sheets, flyers, and maps, which, yes, some of those. I'm just going to put those up, fact sheets, example of fact sheets, and press releases. So this is, you know, a press release that we work really closely with our, you know, our press officers in Region 10. I'm sure a lot of you do. Especially with the restructure where we're in the public affairs offices, that will be, you know, you'll have an even closer relationship if you didn't have that before. Social media is a big piece. So we have a really active Region 10 Facebook and Twitter feed that our social media specialist, Suzanne Skidowski, updates regularly. She does a phenomenal job. So if you want any social media tips, that you don't already know. Suzanne is a great person and a great resource. Feel free to reach out to her. There's also other outreach materials, and so I'll be talking about, you know, translation in a moment too here, don't worry. But this is an example from Portland Harbor. It's a brain bender. So this is actually a book for kids is what it was geared toward. There's word searches and other fun games in here that educate them about, you know, mainly the fish consumption piece of Portland Harbor being one of resident fish consumption being an issue. This was developed with funds from the Technical Assistance Services for Communities program, which I'll talk about in a moment. And this is an example of a video that was also done with CASC services for the Duwamish Superfund site. So this is another example of an outreach video, an outreach piece. That's rather innovative. You know, you can do webinars, as we're doing here. I've done that with Portland Harbor. You know, that all does take resources, obviously, and time. So that's, you know, it's helpful to have the contract, you know, the task set up where, you know, Tina and Freya out of headquarters do a great job of managing that and providing help. But it does, you know, still take time and effort on your part to manage that work. I will mention, you know, for the fact sheets and, you know, printed material, but also if you're doing any kind of interpretation, if you need interpretation at your meeting, the Office of Civil Rights does have a contract, and we didn't check. I still need to check on exactly when that expires. I think it was going to be renewed because it was actually directly created as a result of that executive order that Monica mentioned earlier in the webinar, and it allows you, if you have a community with environmental justice characteristics, you know, basically fill out a form, and if you need something translated, you check that, you know, that your community has that, and the Office of Civil Rights out of headquarters does have money available to translate materials for you. And they have a great website that outlines the process. I use it regularly. Julie does, too. And so if you have any questions about how to use it, let us know. They also can provide on-site interpreters. For, you know, events that you have. The one thing about the translation I've, you know, heard is that, you know, it is still good to ground truth it or try to check it, you know, with community members if possible, you know, who speak the language at the local level that can help too, because a lot of the translation that's done is not necessarily someone who's in your area specifically. And lastly, the Office of Civil Rights, the other service they offer is they do have a 24-hour interpretation phone hotline that you can call at any time and be connected to an interpreter in whatever language you need. So if there's, you know, an emergency, and that's that can be used. So I'm happy to answer more questions about that, and Julie is too. So moving on, it's another example, just a translation piece, so perfectly. So that was a public notice that we translated for Portland Harbor using that Office of Civil Rights contract. So going over EJ Screen, we're getting closer, don't worry. EJ Screen is a great tool, and it's an important tool. And I'm not going to go into a ton of detail, but this is the actual physical tool we have. You know, in your region, you know, there are
you know, great environmental justice coordinators. Julie and I both work with ours closely for Duwamish and Portland Harbor. And I just want to mention, you know, so EJ Screen, first of all, at that website that's listed, soon will be listed right there on your screen, there's training that you can do on EJ Screen that can be very useful. And it is, I just want to say, you know, first and foremost, a tool to help provide initial information. It's not meant to solely be relied on for decision making. So that's a key thing that I think gets misunderstood and misinterpreted, or has the potential to be. And EJ Screen shows so many things. It can show you the proximity of parks, you know, in schools to a certain area, you know, different environmental hazards that the community is at risk from. And, you know, an example, you know, is something that somebody can show you the percentage of housing stock, you know, pre-1978, which is when lead paint was banned, so you can kind of get a sense of that. The limited English proficiency levels in your community, and more, you know, demographic information. It can be really, really helpful to get a good sense. You just have to be, you know, especially for a site with like Portland Harbor, there's a lot of water, or Duwamish, you know, be careful, you know, about, again, it's a tool, it's not a decision making, it's not to be relied on for decision making. Because if you put, you know, a radius around a certain point and a lot of it's water, that's going to skew your results, right? So you just need to be cognizant of that. So the Superfund Community Involvement Handbook, just want to highlight that again. That's very important to provide guidance, you know, on how to plan and implement community involvement. It has the required activities, and then it has additional activities you can consider. Not every community should have or should necessarily have a high level of community involvement, so that's something to consider. Maybe you are just doing the, you know, required activities, and that's it. You're not going above and beyond. But the handbook has the guidance on how to think through if your community does have additional needs that require more. And then the Community Involvement Toolkit, again, describes different community tools available. I think we're all familiar with those, but they are two different documents, sometimes get confused. So just wanted to mention that. And then just some site team tips very quickly. These are two main ones that I think are important. So, you know, discussing community involvement language with remedial project managers and site team members in decision documents and agreements is important. So if you're a site where the record of decision, the proposed plan leading into the record of decision are being drafted, this is a key point. You know, reviewing that community involvement language as a community involvement coordinator, you know, working with your RPMs on that is important. And Julie, you know, worked really closely with her site team for Duwamish, and there's some, you know, pretty strong language in the record of decision, which you can't always do, obviously, but it is an opportunity to think through, you know, can we, you know, put something in here? Obviously, there's a lot of considerations, your attorneys, you know, if you have a site with PRPs, but, you know, there's something, you know, in their rod, they actually have that there's a body that's created to make decisions.
Yes, and if anybody wants, because I've said it so many times, in our record of decision, it's section 13.2.8, and it's related to the environmental justice analysis that was done for the Duwamish Superfund site. But it requires us to convene an advisory group to mitigate the impacts on the affected community from the cleanup. So that's how we've been able to form the Duwamish Roundtable.
So
in remedial design and action. So it's important to have that language in there.
Yeah, and not every site can do that, obviously, but it's just something to consider, you know, important for you to review if possible. And in agreements like for Portland Harbor, you know, we have a lot of administrative orders settlement agreements with potentially responsible parties right now for remedial design, and there is a community involvement clause in every one of those agreements that we're signing now. And, you know, I was able to, you know, work with our team and just review that. There's, you know, obviously model language that EPA, you know, adheres to, and so you might not be able to change much, but it's good to be aware of it, about what's out there and what the, you know, if you have PRPs at a site or even if you don't, what, you know, community involvement language is in there. And I was able to, you know, add that, you know, PRPs should consider the Superfund Job Training Initiative program if we bring it up as a result of reviewing that. So just good to just be aware of it. If you have PRPs, if you don't have PRPs at your site, it doesn't apply to you as much. But and then ask to review community involvement language in contracts. So, you know, as you all know, a lot of every site has a technical contract So they're technical contractors that support our work, and we're going to be changing to a new system, right, a new contracting system. And there is a community involvement clause in all of those contracts. And so, you know, just working with your site team to see if you can, you know, review or be aware of what that community involvement language is, so you know if you have any other tools at your disposal is important. And I also, you know, manage contracts for other things, which we'll talk about in a moment. But that's just an important thing to do. So technical assistance, that kind of leads nicely into it. So technical assistance is a different piece, a different tool at your disposal. And, you know, technical assistance experts, as it says here, you know, can interpret and explain technical data to help people make informed decisions. So this is an example of some design plans, you know, to the left here for a cleanup that after technical assistance was applied through the Technical Assistance Services for Communities program, there was a plain language summary that was developed to the right. So really important. So experts can be, you know, RPMs or their technical folks in EPA, which are, you know, great, risk assessors, hydrologists, other professionals, you know, via EPA contracts. I'm specifically referencing the Technical Assistance Services for Communities contract that Tina and Frey manage, and I've mentioned that previously. So, you know, they can do a lot of different things. They can do this document translation. That technical assistance contract also, as we mentioned previously, can help with documents that help with technical assistance or products like the video or the Brain Bender book. So it, you know, doesn't have to just be limited to, you know, strict document interpretation, although it's often used for that. And then professionals hired by the community through a technical assistance grant or TAG, and that's obviously mandated by the NCP, and that's an important piece too. So for technical assistance, you know, it should be offered as early as possible, and the assistance should be determined in consultation with the community. And so the only other thing I'll mention is a technical assistance needs assessment, which there's a tool in the toolkit on this. So this is another tool you can use. It's often you can integrate the questions for a TANA with the community involvement plan update or the initial time that you do it. So I'm not going to go into a ton of detail, but it is another tool I want to mention. And it basically helps you advise community available programs, you know, like TASC, early and often. You know, it's a collaboration with the regional program coordinators, and also it helps you, the technical assistance piece, you know, and, you know, that can help you consider a neutral facilitator and CPRC services, which we're going to be talking about in a second. So, again, technical assistance with the site team, you know, discuss that with them early. Early action is key. So before we go into the facilitation piece, which is almost the last piece, the Superfund Job Training Initiative, another tool, just want to mention it. There's a great website on this, so I'm not going to go into a ton of detail, but it is a program at your disposal that is good to think about as early as possible. You know, once you're, you know, kind of in the design phase, I would say, of a site, or, you know, earlier, it's good to give people information about it. It's a job training program where, you know, EPA is basically working, you know, with a contractor, our contractor, to train, you know, community members and provide training and then employment opportunities. Ideally, the goal would be long-term for community members at a site. And so, you know, the one thing I would say is just setting expectations for this program is important, because sometimes community members think that, you know, this will be thousands of jobs that will be created with the Super JTI program, and that's not the case. It's usually smaller, you know, cohorts of like, you know, 8 to 10. It can be more for sure, and it can be done multiple times, but setting expectations is important. So that's all I'm going to say, but it is a tool that is good to know about. So now we're going to go quickly into EPA's Conflict Prevention and Resolution Center, another tool. So it provides, you know, situation assessments, process design, facilitation, assistance obtaining outside facilitators, evaluation, training, so many good things. And, you know, basically I'm not going to read off this completely, but a neutral facilitator can help in a lot of ways. You know, it can help, you know, really show that an organization is committed to listening, considering all points of view, even if it's not necessarily what EPA wants to hear, and therefore it can help with, you know, trust, building trust. And a third party can really help, a third party neutral facilitator can really help get, you know, underneath a party's positions by focusing on their interests And that's, you know, really key. And this is just an example of a facilitator that we have used at Portland Harbor who does visual facilitation, which is a unique tool that we, you know, CPRC has a contract that I manage that we are able to do this work under because of them. So, you know, I was going to say also a third-party intro facilitator can help with complex logistical communication processes, allow EPA to focus on substantive issues. So, you know, the contractor I have through CPRC's contract also helps us with things like venue planning and logistics, so that helps me a little bit, but they do a lot more than that, obviously. And so site team tips, so there is an effort involved in managing a facilitation contract with CPRC. You know, I'm certified as a contract office representative. Some of you might be. It's something to consider doing. It does take a lot of work to manage, even though CPRC is doing a lot of work, too, to manage it. You know, Julie isn't certified, but an RPM on her team is, and so she has a contract with CPRC as a result. So that's just something to think about. And I do just want to mention that Gina Sarasani is on the phone and in the webinar room, and she is with EPA's Conflict Prevention Resolution Center, and she's a conflict resolution specialist who works extensively on Superfund community involvement, and she has a PhD in conflict analysis and resolution and over 10 years of experience in that field. And she's an engaged partner, works closely with Superfund's Community Involvement and Program Initiatives branch, and many of you on site-specific situations. So does anyone have any questions for Gina? Because she actually can't stay for the expert panel. So this would be a good time to ask her any questions.
So, Laura, I'll just let you know, and Gina, you should know, people are typing in messages into the window right now how awesome you are. So please know that your reputation has spread to some of the CICs out in the regions, and they do speak very highly. Laura, it had come in earlier. And so, Gina, a couple of participants are just curious, are there any restrictions in how or when a community can get support if they're getting help elsewhere? So, for example, if they were getting technical assistance under a TASC, can they also get facilitation support through you, or is that sort of blocked because they're already getting support through another avenue?
No, they can absolutely get support through us, too, and, in fact, there are a number of sites where we're providing both task support and conflict prevention and resolution services support. And I usually, with those sites, I work really closely with CPIB, and often we'll even have calls with the contractor who's providing task support and the conflict resolution contractor on the call at the same time so that we're coordinating all of those efforts.
Okay, and I'm seeing another question that came in, and they're kind of interested, how long would it take to get a facilitator through CPRC? Does it take a few weeks or longer? Do your facilitators travel?
So the facilitators absolutely do travel. They're located all over the country, and you know, that's something that we can consider when looking for someone. If it's important to have someone who's more local, you know, we have some flexibility with that, but they do travel. And in terms of timing, it depends on a few things. I would say generally we can get someone up and running within a couple weeks. There are some options. So when I send the technical directive or the task order to the contractor, and then get responses from available and interested facilitators, the EPA site team has the opportunity to interview them if they want, or they could just review the responses and decide on a preference then. So those are some of the kinds of things to consider. You know, I'm working on a site right now where there are about four contenders, or, you know, four interested facilitators, and there likely will be interviews with some or all of them. So, you know, then we get into scheduling, and it might take just slightly longer. But I would say 3 weeks is probably tops to get something started. The only thing that I'll say right now is that we're in a transition between 1 5-year contract and our next 5-year contract. So for the next couple of months, things are potentially a little bit slower.
Awesome. Okay, I don't see any other questions coming in right now. So, Laura, I don't know if you want to keep going.
Sure. Yeah, thank you, Gina. And Gina is awesome. So thank you very much. Gina helps me a lot, and she's always super responsive. I don't know how you do it, Gina. Good job.
Thank you, Gina.
Yes, thank you. I'm going to continue on. So just can't say enough good things about CPRC and their facilitation support. It's just critical. Critical. And actually, Gina, I have one question for you. I was just wondering, do you ever provide facilitation support for internal site teams, like anything like that? Has that ever been something you've done, like if a site team internally at EPA needs any help?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we have provided that kind of assistance, and we can do that.
Okay, great. Thank you. Yes, hello? No one else? Okay, great. Moving on, community involvement resources. So just recapping here, Superfund Community Involvement Handbook, Superfund Community Involvement Toolkit, and Community Involvement Tools and Resources, and Community Involvement University. So that's, you know, partially, you know, this webinar part of that, but Tina Conley, you know, does a great job with CIU, and there's so many good courses that can be taken out to the regions as a result of that. So there's also the Superfund Community Involvement website, which has, you know, links to all of these tools and resources too. So really quickly at the very end, just want to mention the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative as another tool. And, you know, I'm not going to talk too much about this, but this is something, you know, redevelopment throughout the process. I know I have, you know, I worked at the headquarters with Frank Avizzato. Like he, you know, mentioned, redevelopment is something you should always be thinking about as early as possible. And so, you know, the redevelopment, Frank has, you know, some contractor resources at his disposal to help you know, at your sites if you're interested in thinking about this. You know, think about redevelopment at your site, and it provides communities with the tools necessary to reuse and redevelop contaminated properties, such as the Midvale Slag site. You see, this is before 2005, the image here, and then afterwards, so it's transformed. But community input is really important, you know, in that process of deciding what it's going to be. So, you know, a good site team tip: introduce yourself to your regional Superfund redevelopment coordinator. And it's never too early to start talking to your community about reuse because that can help, you know, if you're very early on at a site listing, it can help, you know, the site team kind of think about how things are going to be structured going forward with the work. And just a good thing to think about. So here are the regional Superfund redevelopment coordinators, and give you a moment to look over these. And with that said, I'm going to go to the next slide. Final slide. Just in review, you know, community involvement plays a significant role in Superfund. Early planning is important. Community involvement actions are required. You know, some are required for removal and remedial actions, but there are other ones to consider depending on the level of interest of your community. The Community Involvement Handbook really outlines that. And Appendix A, though, shows, you know, the community involvement actions that were required. And the two charts that Julie mentioned that are available for download do as well. Technical assistance is available for communities, so we went over that, you know, with TASC, TAG, you know, considering doing a technical assistance needs assessment on its own or as part of a community involvement plan. Third-party neutral facilitation is available. CPRC, amazing resource, you know, think about utilizing them. And, you know, always consider reuse and development as early as possible. That's all I have. Thank you.
Awesome.
Awesome.
Thank you. So I believe we are going to move on to the next and probably highly coveted portion of our training, a 5-minute break. So I'm going to go ahead and set a timer on the screen, and you all have 5 minutes to use the facilities, get a drink of water, do whatever you need to do, and we will resume with the training here in approximately 5 minutes. So by my clock, 2:38 p.m. Eastern, come back and be ready to carry on the training with us. So we'll stay here live in headquarters waiting. The line will be muted during that brief break, but we will be here ready to get started in just under 5 minutes. Okay, just a brief reminder, we're going to be resuming from our break here in just a few seconds. I'm going to unmute our next presenter, Pam Avery. So Pam, you're going to hear a message here in a second that your line has been unmuted. Pam, are you with me?
I sure am.
Oh, woohoo! All right, just a few more seconds left here.
It worked.
It did. That's a good thing when technology works. I'm happy for that. I wanted to double check, and again, for the live audience, the 5 minute break is wrapping up. So if you could type a message into the Q&A window in the bottom right corner and just confirm that you are back at your desk or back in the room and you are ready to keep going, that will help us make sure that you've all virtually come back into the training room and you're excited to get going. So again, I'm starting to see some messages pop in here. And we're going to carry on with some fun interactive training. And I see, who does it look like has come back? Elizabeth, thank you for confirming that you're back. So I'm going to go ahead and, again, just if you come back to your desk, run over to that keyboard, type in a message into the Q&A window, and let us know that you are back. Oh, Kirsten, thank you for confirming you're back. Okay, so I'm starting to see more of those messages come in. I think, perhaps, if you want to take over, please, by all means, do.
Okay, great. Well, first off, it's great to be back with everyone. I certainly enjoyed the first part of the of the training. I always learned so much from it myself, actually. So, Julie, Laura, I thought it was just fabulous, and hopefully this will build upon it. So anyway, in this part, excuse me, of the presentation, we're really going to be talking about confidence creating credibility, because really that's sort of the fundamental thing that we're trying to get across in some of the, especially the presentation delivery style that we'll be discussing here and some of the tools and techniques. In this segment, excuse me, just a second, I'm still recovering, unbelievably or not, from some bronchitis. So if I'm a little raspy, I do apologize. We're going to be coming up with some confidence-building practices to help you and your CICs and other EPA staffers come across as credibly as possible at public meetings and in other audience engagements. Also going to share some tips on coping with conflict, dealing with anger, and finally, coping with stress. But before we get into all of that, and speaking of stress, and speaking of standing and delivering, we're going to do a few stress buster exercises. And Jean is going to be right up there helping us out. Well, wait, and Tina, oh my gosh, and Tina too. we've got a duo. Okay, so everybody up, everybody who's already up, stay up. Those of you who aren't, please get up. Stand on one leg and shake the other leg, okay? Do it really vigorously. Okay, now switch legs. Very good. I always tell folks out here in the West where I live, if you're wearing cowboy boots, take them off. I've seen a couple of folks drop over on their side doing these. So do take off any cowboy boots or high heels. Okay, now shake your hands really fast. Shake them above your head. Okay, now bending at the wrist and elbow, bring your hands down, back down. Come on. Okay, just like Jean and Tina. Very, very good. Okay, now let's ease our facial muscles, because frankly, when we're tense, the first thing that shows is within our faces, and that's the very thing we want to be projecting as much confidence and calm as possible, especially during our public meetings. So open your mouth as wide as possible. Think of Edvard Munch's The Scream. Oh my God, Jean, that's a great scream. Okay, close. Okay, open and close your mouth again. Very, very good. Okay, now shoulder and neck rolls. Imagine your eye level with a clock. Okay, now lift your face up to the 12 o'clock position. Now move it to the 3. Okay, down to the 6. Now over to the 9. Now reverse and repeat. And do this slowly. I have found if you do it too quickly, you can get dizzy. So do it slowly. Very good. Okay, and finally, before you go into any kind of a meeting, any kind of community engagement, even maybe a conflict situation with your own family, think positive. You know, repeat, I can do this. I've got it. I'm confident in what I'm saying. I have done what I can. All right. Thank you very much, ladies. Very, very good. Okay, so the very first rule of engagement is be prepared. And part of what we need to do to help our CICs and those of you who are OSCs and are going to be doing some training, be prepared, is really looking at the meeting fundamentals. Laura and Julie did an excellent job of talking about strategies, the CIPs, the communication strategies, you know, what you need to do to prepare for your meetings. I just want to dig a little bit into, you know, just some of the real basic fundamentals that oftentimes you all who are veterans out there know these by heart, but oftentimes someone who's new to the organization or maybe new just to doing the kind of public speaking that you've done doesn't necessarily know. So first off, you need to train folks to know the situation inside and out. You know, do the research that's necessary. Meet the people in the community if it's a community meeting. Okay, know your audiences and what they need to know. What are their biggest fears or concerns? What's their level of understanding? If they're laymen, avoid the technical jargon. Define the acronyms. And quick, what does ROD mean? Okay, everybody type this in. What does it mean, ROD? I don't see anyone typing. Okay, how about, pardon me?
So look, I'm seeing them in there. They might be a little slow in their messaging here, but
okay.
There's a whole lot of them in there.
Uh-oh, okay. Well, I'm for some reason, I am not seeing them, but I'm going to assume that you guys know what all this stuff means. Okay, what about ATSDR, CERCLA? Okay, you guys are pros. You're pros. But remember, your communities often aren't. And I can't tell you how many times I have seen, you know, when I facilitate community meetings and someone talking about ATSDR, one fellow came up, he said, is that like Telstar, that satellite? And, of course, that sort of derailed the meeting for a bit while we explained that it wasn't the satellite but something else. So just, you know, watch your acronyms. Okay, also use analogies where appropriate. Okay, first off, no, you know, and I believe we've covered this quite well in the last couple of sessions, but of course know where your audiences are in the community involvement process. There's no point in, you know, you being one place when actually they're still in another place. That's where you end up having a lot of conflict, as those of you who, you know, are out there leading or facilitating community meetings, I'm sure, can attest. Okay, know what the audience expects. You know, general information, process and timelines, a clear role, often a significant role, respect, responsiveness, and empathy. That's what they expect. And this is what's going to, you know, we're going to be talking about a bit more. Okay, so the basics, you know, again, determine the right place to gather and exchange information. Set the stage for effective public participation. Obviously, practice, practice, practice. Urge your folks to practice with you if you're doing your training. Do a dry run well before the meeting. We did that actually with this webinar a couple of months ago. Well, not even a couple of months ago, about a month ago, and then again, not too long before we delivered this webinar today. Consider the questions that are likely to arise. Make the most of room dynamics. You know, for instance, if the room's, you know, too small, you know, first off, see if you can find a larger room if you have a large amount of folks coming. If it's the room is, frankly, too large, maybe you only have a handful of folks come and they're sitting all over the heck in the auditorium, you know, get them to come closer, you know, close to where you are. Put your chairs in a circle. I've done that. We were expecting a huge turnout at a meeting in Brownville, you know, a couple of years back, and it turned out there was another meeting going on about water tap fees, and nobody came to our meeting. I think we had 4 people come, and we had 5 presenters. So, you know, we threw out the PowerPoint, threw out everything else, and just had them sit in a circle, and essentially, you know, we sort of had a nice chat, and the ones who were there said they really learned a lot, and they went on to tell some of their folks, too. Okay, agree on the ground rule. The purpose of the meeting, be clear and specific. Many people will be coming to those meetings, as you know, expecting to talk about all kinds of issues, environmental and otherwise, that may be going on in their communities. The meeting format and agenda, you know, I'm sure you all have agendas when you go into this, but, you know, certainly tell folks in advance what to expect at the meeting. The Q&A format, will there be a time limit? If there is, certainly state that up front, you know, probably with your ground rules, and then state it again before your Q&A. You know, obviously, if someone's running over but they have something very emotional to say, you know, that's where you give them a little extra time. I certainly do in those sessions. But again, sticking to the time limit can certainly help if you have a limited amount of time in a facility and you have a lot of people who really do and want to, you know, to talk about the issue at hand. Also, tell them when the meeting's going to conclude, and again, on the expectation of mutual respect. Okay, hold on here. Let me see. Okay, Jean, it appears I'm kind of stuck here for whatever reason.
All right, let's see if I can't get it forward a little.
Thank you. Sorry about this, folks. I am clicking both little things here. Okay, so well, now let's talk about delivery. You know, just how we're going. Now you kind of got the fundamentals down, but let's talk about you know, how we're going to say what we need to say now that we have our meeting set up the way we wish. We know what we're doing. We know who we're speaking to. We know our audiences and whatnot. And you know, there are four ways, and only four ways, in which we have contact with the world. We are evaluated and classified by these four contacts: what we do, how we look, what we say, and how we say it. Okay, whoops. Sorry, it's working now. Okay. So, again, getting back to confidence creates credibility. Voice is our most powerful tool. And I'm going to, Jean's setting up here, a little video, and I want you to listen closely. This is Margaret Thatcher when she first became Prime Minister. And then, you know, a number of years later, after she had quite a bit of training and quite a bit of experience under her belt. And I want you to listen to this, and then we'll discuss it a bit.
Okay. So, Pam, I'm going to mute you here so that the audio will play back through the movie. We'll watch this brief clip, and then we'll unmute you.
I haven't had really much time to think about it. After all, I know I'm still only me, and so do my family. But I'm very much aware of the responsibilities and a little bit apprehensive. Who wouldn't be when you think of the names that I follow?
Let me answer that very deeply, because I feel very strongly about it. The greatest divisions this nation has ever seen were the conflicts of trade unions towards the end of a Labour government.
Okay, Pam, you're with us?
Okay, yes, I am. And thank you. Hold on, I'm just going to mute my audio on the computer so it doesn't reverberate. Okay, so listening to Margaret, the Iron Lady there, she became known as, what was different? What did you find different about how she was delivering? And obviously she had a couple of different messages there, but what was different? Any comments here?
And so we were chatting here in the room amongst ourselves, and so for participants, you can type in messages into the Q&A window, but we noticed that she just seemed really sure of herself. Like, she emphasized and, like, looked that man in the eye. Let me say, you know, I feel very strongly about this. So just seemed really confident and sure. Mm-hmm. What about you, Tina?
Yeah.
Oh, I agree.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I'm not suggesting that you all get out there and be Margaret Thatcher talking about the labor movement. You know, certainly you don't need to be quite that forceful about things. But mostly, yes, that's exactly what I was hoping to get across here, is that, you know, she is more confident. You know, and of course, here she was. I mean, as she said in her first message there, she's following in the footsteps of the greats, you know, Winston Churchill and others. And, you know, and she was a little apprehensive. Unfortunately, it was kind of showing up in her voice, too. Now, the backstory here is, I got a chance to kind of read some of that, is right after that, they did decide she needed some coaching. And she actually did go through quite extensive vocal coaching and all kinds of things. So, you know, she was certainly well prepared when she went before her parliament and whatnot. So, okay, so moving on here. So one quick thing about uptalk or upspeak, as some call it, you know, that's ending a sentence with a question. First of all, it isn't always bad. I mean, sometimes you're trying to elicit a response from a community, or sometimes it is a question, or sometimes you know, it's okay to sound a little tentative about something. However, if you do it chronically and frequently, it's going to detract from your message, from what you're, the information you're trying to, you know, to get across to people. So a little exercise here, and I want everyone in your rooms, you're going to drive one another crazy, I know, but say, I have something to say. Jean, why don't you say it for us, both ways, if you can.
So first way with a question mark.
Yes.
I have something to say. And then the second way, okay, here. I have something to say.
That's right. Or I have something to say. Do you see the difference? Okay. Also, varying your our volume, our pitch, and our speed, using force to emphasize key points. Again, another exercise. And again, you're going to get all of these slides, I understand. You'll be able to replay all of this, but also you'll get this and you'll be able to work on this yourself, but also give it to others to train. So change your tone, okay? Add surprise. Jean?
This new CERCLA policy is going to be extremely effective.
Yeah, irony.
This new CERCLA policy is going to be extremely effective.
Anger.
This new CERCLA policy is going to be extremely effective.
So, as you can see, very good, Jean. Thank you. By changing the volume, your pitch, the words you emphasize, it makes a whole different meaning to the sentence, the words that you're saying. Also, when you're giving a long presentation in particular, it really helps. I'm sure each of us attending this has been at presentations where someone talks in a monotone like this and they just keep going. And after a while, you just want to leave is what you want to do. You're not listening to the person anymore. Instead, you're probably doodling or trying to figure a way out of whatever the presentation is that you're in. So, okay, more vocal tips. Sorry about that. Moving ahead a little too. You know, pause from time to time. You're going to appear thoughtful and in command. One thing that's not on here, though, which I have been doing, probably to the point of detriment here very soon, but drinking lots and lots of water before you have to speak, because it really does help, especially if you have a bit of a rasp in your throat or a cough or whatever, it really does help. And there's others. Again, you're going to get quite a few more in the guide, but I'll move along because I know we have a lot to cover in not too much time. Okay, body language speaks volumes. So I pulled up this little chart a number of years back, but in terms of how we process information, verbal, your tone, inflection, etc., as we were just talking about, that's about 38% of how we tend to, process information. Nonverbal, the body language is almost the same percentage. It's 35%. You know how you're appearing. I'm sure we've all seen folks that are clutching their arms tightly to themselves. They've got their arms folded. They're wincing. You know, they're doing a lot of things with their face, their arms. You know, their legs. That just convey discomfort. And so body language is critical. And our words, okay, 7% of everything people are absorbing about what you're saying is through the actual words. A lot of it is, again, as you can see from the chart, verbal tone, inflection, and the nonverbal. Okay, so a few things to help with body language. First off, if you're wobbling all over the place or drifting all over the place, that's going to detract from your credibility, because people are going to be so, or I should say from your message and probably your credibility too, because people are going to be so busy watching you bob around the stage or on the floor that they're just not going to be paying attention. So what we recommend folks do is to place their feet in a modified V shape, you know, with your knees just a little bit flexed, don't tighten them all the way. That really does help. And again, you don't have to do it right now unless you happen to be standing already. But do try it on your own before you do a presentation or, just at home, and also something to help folks that you're training. Okay, don't jam your hands into your pockets or jingle coins or keys, especially guys out there. I hear a lot of jinglers sometimes when I'm, facilitating meetings, and folks get up, they're a little nervous, they've got their hands in their pockets, and by gosh, there's the coins and the key rings going too. Okay, it's okay to gesture with your hands, just not over your eyes. Don't grip or hide behind a podium. It's really best if you can stand to the side of the podium. When you're seen clutching a podium, what does that convey? Nervousness. Okay, eye contact and facial expressions. You know, don't read from your notes. I mean, I realize if you're doing very complex, you know, if you're getting very complex information or very precise information, yes, you should have notes. You should look down at them. You know, your PowerPoint, perhaps, they're on your PowerPoint. But again, the more you can memorize and be conversational when you get to those spots in your presentation, perhaps, that are not so technical, the more helpful it will be to your audience and the more engaged they'll be with you. Again, don't talk to the power screen. There's nothing worse than looking at the back of someone's head during an entire presentation, and chances are you've lost your audience then. A gaze around the room, not at one person or one spot. Okay, look at your audience. Now, this is something I've heard, actually. Actually, I've heard other trainers talk about, oh, well, if you're really nervous, look over their heads. Well, don't. What will happen is people know you're looking over their heads, and they're wondering what you're looking at, and chances are they're going to turn around to see what you're looking at. So, you know, look at your audience, look from person to person. It does help with engagement. Okay, use facial expressions to make a point. If you have a startling statistic, it's okay to raise your eyebrows a bit. Okay. Okay, well, let's talk about coping with conflict, because, and we're going to show you a little clip here, but increasingly, this is what I am seeing at the meetings that I facilitate or in the trainings that we do, where we have CICs, OSCs, and others who are who are out there with their communities. It is getting quite contentious out there. And sort of the rule of manners has kind of gone out the door. So I'm going to show a little clip. This was a fellow, actually, with the police chief in L.A. There had been a police shooting. He was invited in to speak to this community. I want you to take a close look at this. What did he do right, and what could he have done better? Okay? We'll go ahead and show this now, and I'm going to mute my computer so it doesn't reverberate.
Okay, we've muted Pam. Just a reminder, audio is going to play back through your computer.
About the death of a young man with a criminal past, a man from not even around here. But Elizabeth Cook shows us it was more about years of one community's pent-up frustration.
I ran through a crowd of men that lost.
Chief Greg Sir took to the podium at the Bayview Opera House to address the details of the shooting death of Kenneth Wade Harding. Moments after he began to speak, chaos erupted. He was drowned out by angry shouting from the crowd. One man had to be held back from charging the podium. After over an hour of failed attempts to speak, Chief Sir left the meeting.
This is a distraction, and it's a tragedy for sure.
A lot of the passion and frustration heard here tonight is from victims of gun violence in the community. Community leaders who organized this meeting say this is a rare opportunity for the victims of gun violence to have their voices heard to police and to Chief Sir directly about the violence in their neighborhood.
Hey, Jack, my friend, you got 36 bullets out here. Six in the head.
You're talking about a group of people that have been voiceless, that have been victimized. I mean, there's countless stories, valid concerns that are being raised. So what if it's not the most articulate way? But it's still impassioned, and it's a very human response, and I think that's what we're seeing out here today.
Kenneth Harding, a parolee and person of interest in a murder in Seattle, was shot by police at the Bayview Muni station after police say he fired at them first.
People are upset that an act of violence happened in their town square, but we were doing our best to make sure that Mr. Harding didn't do any violence to the community.
But people who attended the meeting weren't ready to hear the details from police. Chief Sir says he's not giving up.
We just keep working with the community of the Bayview.
Now, there were people at the meeting here tonight, Dana, that were outraged over Kenneth Harding's death, but many of the people who took the podium wanted to talk about their loved ones that had been killed, some several years ago. Others took to the podium to talk about what they say was police brutality or profiling. It seemed like tonight's meeting and the shooting of Kenneth Harding was a lot like putting salt on what people in the Bayview view as an open wound.
Elizabeth, I'm wondering if there was any mention of a meeting in the near future about this or anything else.
Yes, they are planning on having future.
Okay, are you there, Jean?
Yep, we're here.
Okay, great. Okay, yeah, I went ahead and said, I'm sorry, I didn't realize I could have stopped that much sooner, so I apologize. That went on probably a bit longer than we needed. But so what? First off, what could this police chief have done differently? What would you have done in his situation?
And so I'll let the audience type in some suggestions. I know a number of you have been pretty active in responding to these questions. Tina, since you're sitting right next to me, what do you think you could have done differently?
I would have addressed their concerns up front, some of the things that they would be worried about, acknowledge how they're feeling, where they're coming from.
And Pam, mm-hmm. Elizabeth has a suggestion that he should have invited the man from the audience up to the podium to talk.
Yeah.
Saying listen more, talk less. Some people were saying that his tone really was off and he should have been or could have been more empathetic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. We also, in addition to this clip, we also had a YouTube video that was taken by one of the citizen journalists, so to speak, there, someone who basically recorded the whole thing just on their smartphone, which happens a lot of times now at public meetings. And it was way crazier. I mean, there was a guy with a chair that was running up towards the podium. I mean, this guy was completely surrounded by angry people. Had he invited the fellow up from the floor, chances are that he never would have gotten any, he already had no control over the meeting, but chances are that would have been the end of the meeting. Some suggestions about this that I've heard in other classes that we've had this, and actually from my own experience facilitating and being, thankfully not anything quite this bad, but in some that came pretty close, is first off, as I think it was Gina who said, it's the wrong format for this meeting. What they needed and wanted was a listening session. So yes, he should have been there acknowledging what happened, listening to the folks there, probably not in that particular arena, you know, maybe something, frankly, where he had a little more protection. You know, one thing that we have been training folks to do in our spokesperson training is to give yourself room. As I say, these many public meetings, particularly if it's over a controversial or a contentious Superfund or other site, are becoming increasingly hostile. And give yourself some space. You know, don't be there where people can be poking at you, you know, or literally, in this case, you know, running at you and that type of thing. If you have to have a table between you and your community, your audience there, so be it. But again, in this case, he tried to do the right thing. He had it in a church. He had, you know, the preacher there introducing him. That was before the video started. And, you know, he thought that would calm things down, but clearly he didn't understand just how upset this community was, and not because of this particular shooting. Yeah, I mean, certainly it's fed into it, but by just the pattern that had been going on in this community. So anyway, and I'm sure, I'm going to love to read what you each suggest there, because I know it's going to be helpful to me and hopefully to others. But let's move on for other ways to maybe deal with, you know, with conflict. Okay, so a little quiz here. Okay, true or false, if I'm doing my job right, there won't be conflict. Okay, the person or group I'm having a conflict with is my enemy. True or false? Okay, all conflicts can be resolved. Conflicts are simply caused by poor communication. Okay, well, you guys pretty much aced it. There are a couple of things that all conflicts can be resolved. And I'm not entirely sure, and Gina is the pro there, but I'm not entirely sure that all conflicts can be resolved to the complete satisfaction of all parties. But in the work that you all are doing with the EPA, you know, certainly there'll be times where you know, somebody wants something completely removed and there's no way to remove it. Well, to them, that's always going to be a conflict, but you're doing what you can do regulatorily as well as ethically, morally, and every other way that you deal with your community. So, okay, helping CICs and others here deal with anger, okay, have them reflect on, again, this is looking at what your community is about, and I know Laura and Julie mentioned this, you know, kind of put yourself, you know, walk in their shoes for a while. What's driving the anger? You know, and it's going to depend on what exactly it is that, you know, you're meeting about or you're engaging them about. But certainly think about, okay, what's driving the anger? Like the police chief there, chances are it wasn't one incident. It's just the compilation of things that are happening, the pattern, the feeling that they're not being validated, that they're not being valued, that type of thing. Okay, if the situation reversed, you know, how would the people you're training, yourself and others, feel in their place? Okay, are they really hearing what the person is saying? Are you really hearing that person? You know, take a look at their body language. You know, their not just their actions, but their words, their body language, as we talked about before. Okay, so coping with stress, what CICs that you're going to be training and dealing with need to know. Okay, first off, don't become defensive, because with defensive comes loss of credibility. It does. And you need to come across as credible as possible if people are to really comprehend and understand what it is that you're trying to convey to them. It's not about you. The anger really is about the situation. Becoming defensive simply undermines that credibility and leaves you open to further attack. Okay, project confidence. That's kind of what we've been talking about all along here. That body language does count. Adjust your posture and demeanor so that you appear relaxed and listening. Now, I know firsthand that's easier said than done, because I've been in front of a lot of angry people, and it's really, really hard to stay relaxed. Someone asked us at a workshop recently, well, what do you do? Well, sometimes you just have to literally take a moment of silence to yourself, kind of get your heart rate back down, and then, you know, begin again, maybe with introductions of the folks that were there, just to buy yourself some time, you know, to feel confident. Okay, the timeout. Raise your hand, just as I was saying, and ask for a moment of silence. You know, use that moment to take a few deep breaths and to remember again, this is not about you personally. Okay, know that you have friends out there. Look around at those in the room who support what you're doing, including your teammates, your community members who are there because they want to hear what you're doing about a site or an issue. Okay, and then know your limitations. You know that you've thoroughly prepared for this encounter, and this is what you're going to convey to the folks that you're training. Okay, you know what's expected of you in this situation. You know you're willing to go the extra mile. I know many of you that are on this call, and you do go that extra mile all the time. Okay, however, you do not have all the power. Except that you have done the very best you can, there'll be another time to engage with these stakeholders. These projects of yours don't go away anytime soon. They just don't. Okay, so finally, in conclusion, leadership has been defined as the ability to hide your panic from others. And with that, I turn the podium back over to Jean and to Tina.
Okay, well, I think we're getting ready to segue to the last segment on the agenda, correct? And Tina, would you like to remind the audience what this segment will be?
This is your opportunity to ask our fabulous trainers, Julie Congdon and Laura Knutson and Pam Avery, any questions you might have for them. So go ahead and type them in. Jean's going to crowdsource these questions, and we're going to do our best to answer as many as we can in the time that we have. And, of course, the ones that get the most votes, we'll start with those.
All right. So there's been a little shift in the windows, and you all will see a new box now that's labeled panel questions. So in that window, you can type in your question at the very bottom of it and hit the enter or send button when you're done typing it in. I'm going to put one in myself just as an example. And as people start sending in questions, you actually have the ability in the audience to vote and pick the questions that you really want to have answered by the panel. So if you hover your cursor near the white space to the right of questions that have come in, you can see a plus one or minus one up here, depending on if you voted for it or not. And if you click the plus one, you can kind of cast a vote for it. So as these questions start coming in, you can view them and you can add your votes if you really like them and include them in there. So I'm going to be copying in some questions that we had come in throughout the broadcast today. But if you didn't send in a question earlier, now is a great time to go ahead and send in your contributions for the panel members. And then we'll take a look and see which ones are the most popular questions, and we'll start with those ones first. So let's go back here. I'm going to see here. Let's see. And so I'm copying some questions in. And I just wanted to remind everybody that the nature of these questions, they don't necessarily have to be specific to CI. They can also be on the train the trainer aspect for this course. So if you have specific questions for the panel about training deliveries or how you might deliver a CI training in your region, you can include those in there as well. So again, you can look at these questions. You can hover your mouse cursor on the far right to a question, and you'll see a plus one button appear. And you can vote on questions that you think are very popular, so, or that you would like to see answered first. Usually I get to pick the questions. This time you all get to help us pick the questions. So I think we've got a couple of them here in the queue, and there clearly is a popular question in the queue. So I'm going to read this one out loud, if it's okay,
we'll just
start here, but the audience can keep sending in their questions and comments, and we'll keep pulling from them as time permits. So this one I think is open to everyone on the panel, and Tina, maybe even you on this one. Are there resources available to help RPMs or the technical staff fine-tune their presentations to better communicate with the participants at public meetings? And I think this is, when they were chatting in this comment, there was a concern that the technical staff get too technical, and they do a lot of the things that Pam was saying not to do, where they read their slides and they don't do something that's relatable to the community. So is there something at EPA that can be used to help them?
Well, there's definitely something, and Laura, I think, referred to it earlier. The Community Involvement University Training Program has quite a selection of courses that address different things, presentations, facilitation, and it is open, and the site team is encouraged to participate in those regional deliveries and to work. If you have a course that you think that would help you, go to your CIC, go to your Community Involvement Manager, and let them know that next time there's an opportunity to bring Community Involvement University training to your region, I'm interested in this. And that communication will go back and forth between me and this Community Involvement Managers or whoever the Community Involvement University lead is.
All right.
Thank you. Hey, this is Laura, and then Julie, if you want to pop in too. I just say that would echo what Tina said. That's awesome. You know, Pam's spokesperson training came to Region 10, and I took it, and I think it's the best training I've ever taken. And that was a result of, you know, folks in our region coordinating that with Tina, and Tina's awesome coordination too. And the other thing I would say, you know, and this is tricky because if you have a team maybe that isn't, like, as enthused about community involvement work or maybe doesn't see the value as much, this could be difficult. But I'm fortunate with Pearl and Harbor that the team sees the value. And so we do, you know, a dry run to help, you know, kind of prep. And I have, sometimes I'll have, if we're doing a presentation that's particularly complicated or contentious, I've, you know, sometimes I'll have people come in, like a fellow CIC on a different site, or, you know, maybe someone else outside of the CI realm who doesn't really know the issue, come in and listen to them giving the presentation so they can provide feedback on it. It's not coming from me. It's coming from, you know, someone else. And maybe, you know, yeah, anyway, so that's been helpful to have that dry run piece. Sometimes you might not have the time or interest, I realize that, but it's helpful. And then also doing a debrief after the meeting, I think it's helpful. It doesn't have to be long. You know, like, people don't have time, and it's hard to fit debrief in, and you can't always do it. But, you know, trying to do maybe like a 15-minute debrief even 15 minutes could be helpful, and just do a quick, like, you know, round of, like, what people thought went well, what people, you know, didn't think or could be improved. That's just something you can do. It's a resource you can help provide potentially for the team, but it can be difficult. Yeah, I understand to do that. Julie, do you have anything you want to say?
I would agree with that. And, you know, depending on the relationship you have with the community advisory group at your Superfund site, maybe you can bring somebody in from that just to, you know, go through the presentation and just see from their perspective if they can say, yeah, that seems accessible or not, or, like, you know, half of that stuff just went over my head, or, you know, if you could do, like, almost a dry run with them, you know, to kind of test it with them. And I don't know if we want to go through the question chronologically, but I think this kind of relates to a question that someone posed about, you know, do you have just images as a slide, or, you know, what do you do with your presentation? And I think, you know, as much as you can try to have images up there, less text, more images, I think are always good, because that's what people like to see. And, you know, I don't think we can make TED Talks out of all of our presentations at a Superfund site, but I think the principles that you see some people do for theirs, you know, when they give TED Talks, I think it's a kind of a good kind of approach to it, to, you know, make it more visually engaging, you know, and that way people will listen to you rather than staring at the screen and reading it. You know, unless you have, you're trying to cite statistics, I just think people will be focusing on you more and listening more, because that's kind of the whole point, is that you're having a conversation with these folks about the site you're working at.
Thank you. I see another question that came in from Monica, and a number of people have voted for this one. What are some of the common pitfalls or mistakes that you see with new CICs or OSC RPM teams when they're first gathering to conduct community involvement? So let's start with Julie and then go to Laura. Julie, anything that you usually see newbies do?
I guess I'm thinking of it when I'm thinking, you know, it's not even just new, but I think of, like, some seasoned RPMs, as much as, you know, they may have been around for a while and they still get overly technical, and it's like, you got to scale it back. And then they, you know, do it again and they think it's more, I'm like, nope, got to scale it back, you know. Like, just it bears repeating that, you know, a lot of this will go over folks' heads, and I'm like, if I can say, I don't even understand what you've just said, you know. And I mean, I have an environmental background and I feel like I understand some of this stuff, but, you know, with the Duwamish, we don't have just Superfund, but or CERCLA, we also have RCRA sites, you know, and so some of the RCRA stuff is, I was like, you lost me. You got to make it simpler, you know, and so it's just revising, and again, trying to have them understand, like, look, you know, understand that these people aren't experts, and, you know, have some empathy that, you know, they're not going to understand, and if they don't understand, they'll think that you're trying to hide something from them. Again, this gets to kind of being transparent. You know, in that, and being accessible, that you want to make the information understood by folks.
And this is Laura. It's such a good question, and it's, you know, tricky. Like, I guess I haven't worked with a lot of new CICs. I'm kind of thinking of this question for myself, being a new CIC, you know, about 3 years ago to Portland Harbor, and I think, you know, I guess, I have seen a lot of new RPMs come onto the Portland Harbor team, so I guess I can kind of answer from that perspective. And so I guess I've seen kind of the reverse of this too, where not necessarily a pitfall or mistake, but I guess, you know, I've seen some new RPMs come on who are really good at asking those key questions that we went over in the beginning, you know, like what are the goal, like what's the goal of this thing that we're talking about, you know, who's the audience, what are the messages. I've also seen, you know, people, and including myself too, like I don't, you know, sometimes I will make a mistake, and I've made mistakes in not asking those questions. So I guess just that's kind of a basic thing, you know, those basic pieces, I think, is that asking those basic questions is something. From a CIC perspective, too, I think some of those, I guess one thing that I've noticed, and I try to stay focused on, but I think it's difficult for me and also my team, is, you know, yeah, sticking to those basics. Like some of those things that Julie went over, you know, phone calls, emails to community members, or even just partners, you know, who we have relationships. Sometimes that basic stuff doesn't happen. And I can't tell you how many times, you know, when that basic stuff doesn't happen, I've seen blow-ups occur. And I think it's just hard sometimes, you know, when you start to see a squirrel go this way or a squirrel go that way, you follow it and you sometimes forget and get mired in the details and don't do those basic things, you know, giving people a heads up about stuff. And that's just critical, you know, and I've just seen, like, my, you know, sometimes I get distracted by that. Sometimes I've seen RPMs get distracted by that, too. It's just difficult. So that's probably the main thing.
Okay. And so just kind of related to that technical question, and Julie, you had hit on it earlier. Somebody else had asked, Pam, do you suggest using only pictures on your slides and not using words to kind of force yourself to speak rather than to read?
You know, I think it depends on what you're presenting, of course, but whenever you can use images, visuals, it really does help a lot. I think what you want to avoid is just overloading any kind of information tool, be it a bulletin or a PowerPoint slide, with too much words, too much information, or even too many visuals. But yes, to answer your question briefly, yeah, certainly. But again, it depends. I mean, sometimes just having a little subhead, you know, a couple of words subhead helps just to kind of put it in the context and then go from there.
One thing I would add to that, too, is if you are giving a presentation to a multilingual community, as much as you can keep just images and graphics that don't need translation, that'll be better, because you'll have a translator that will already be translating what you're saying, but if they're going to have to translate what's on the slide as well, that's going to take more time. So as much as you can keep it visual is probably better.
Okay, so I see some other questions that are in the queue about the materials and questions about how often to give this training, and so more specific in the delivery of the training itself. And I think we're going to touch on the resources and where they can find that and in just a moment, so I'm going to put those off to the side. But I did want to take just one last question here for the panel. And this one is, how do you get a community involved in a positive way? So maybe you're reaching out, but they're not showing up, or they're only giving you very negative feedback and not giving you much to work with other than them being angry at EPA. Any tips or suggestions to get a community engaged or involved in a positive way? And maybe we'll start with Julie.
I'm contemplating, but Laura's ready to answer.
I'll just start with one thought, and that's kind of what I said before. I mean, so I have to say, I mean, the Portland Harbor Superfund site is the main experience that I have, and so that's not, I would not classify that currently as a highly, highly contentious community. You know, it's not the same as a lot of sites that I know some of you on the call have, or the webinar have dealt with or are dealing with. But I would just say, I think those community interviews, you know, doing some one-on-one sit-downs with folks can be really helpful, and even just offering, even offering to do that, even if you're turned away, just offering to do that is a really powerful thing. And I know it helped with me being new to the site. When I did that for Portland Harbor, there was some, you know, some animosity, I would say, some anger when I came onto the site. being new helps with that. So I think that could be difficult if you're a CIC that's been on the site for a long time. But that was really helpful to build relationships, and I think you can do that, you know, doing that really helped us. But then also following through, you know, on what you say you're going to do. You know, I mean, one other thing I'll just mention, too, that has been kind of an effective approach for Portland Harbor is we, you know, and not every site is like this, again, so take what you want from this, but we get a lot of political attention, right? And so we have, you know, we've had senior officials come and want to meet with community leaders. And that's, I know, not something every site gets. And so, but one thing that we've used, and you could maybe use this tactic in other ways too, is we've asked for questions from community leaders in advance of those meetings. And then we actually, you know, go over them at the meetings. And we work internally to develop talking points for folks, you know, internally. And it's just a more productive meeting because community leaders feel like, you know, they see their questions reflected and the meeting, and then they actually see the senior leaders, you know, working to respond to the questions, and then there is some facilitated dialogue that occurs. So that's, you know, maybe not in a senior leader setting. Maybe you could do that in a different setting too. That's just one thought. But Julie,
mm-hmm. It's hard. I mean, I'm trying to think, or you know, kind of what's the low hanging fruit, and then there's the high hanging fruit. You know, in some ways, I think to get them involved in a positive way is also approaching them in a positive manner. And I think it's, you know, going to where they're at, and that's like going into their community and, like, you know, having those kind of informal coffee chats. It's like, hey, I'm here, I'm where you are, and, you know, you're basically going to their turf and trying to do it in a very hopefully relaxed, casual manner to be approachable. But it's also, you know, showing up when, like, there's a restoration event that happens twice a year. It's called Duwamish Alive, and it does habitat restoration and cleanup along the river shoreline, you know, and we show up to that. And it's like, hey, you know, this may not be my neighborhood, you know, but it is in a way because it's my super fun site, and I'm here, and I'm supporting. I'm not saying anything. I'm just here like you, volunteering, working. So it's showing that you too are invested like they are in something that's maybe not even Superfund related. You know, and it's showing up to different events that they have that maybe you don't have a booth there, but just showing that you're trying to be available, that they can see you. That's, you know, I think going back to one of those slides of just being visible in the community. But, you know, thinking back to that public involvement spectrum, it can be very difficult to get to that purple side of the spectrum, and, you know, and that's where I say, like, high-hanging fruit. You know, one effort that we have here with the Duwamish is for the fish consumption institutional controls, and we've been able to manage it that we have a cooperative agreement with Public Health Seattle King County to work with community health advocates. There are three teams, Latino, Vietnamese, and Khmer, or Cambodian, and that they are doing outreach to their communities, which are the ones that we've identified as the highest risk for consuming resident fish. They're contaminated. They know what works for their community on getting that message out about safe fish consumption. You know, we know that fish advisories don't work. You know, posting a sign somewhere is not going to work for somebody. You know, you can see a sign and somebody's going to have a fish crab pot right next to it. So that's where we're working with those communities to develop good messaging. And so that's one positive way we've been able to engage the community, where we will empower you to tell us what are the best messages to reach out to your community, because we can't do it. You need, you know, we're relying on you to tell us what to do, and we will empower you to do that work. We're paying you to do that. It's, again, through the cooperative agreement where Public Health Seattle King County is the one who is paying the community health advocates. So, you know, that's on the spectrum. That's a higher hanging fruit. That can be difficult, I know, for other sites to do that. But that has paid us so many kind of goodwill dividends in the community of being able to get those teams going. And it's in just the short time frame that program has existed, it's been very positive. So there are the low-hanging fruits and the middle-hanging fruits and the high-hanging fruits. So
Kind of a long-winded answer to how can you get them involved in a positive way. But if folks have ideas that they want to share through the chat box, that'd be great to hear too.
Well, I think in the interest of time, we're going to go ahead and close out the panel session, but I want to echo thanks for all of you taking part in the panel session and for people who had sent in questions earlier. I wanted to turn back to Tina here so that we can walk through just a few final items that we had before I do the closeout instructions. So Tina, are there any messages you want to leave, and then I'll jump in here?
Yeah, thanks, Jean, and thank you, Julie and Laura and Pam and Gina for your participation, and all of you for taking time out of your busy days to participate in this webinar. And I think one of the biggest messages is that one is please build your regional teams. You have seasoned CICs, you have new CICs, you have with so many things. Come together, build your network in your region and outside of your region. Folks are always willing to share their experiences and their resources and information that's not covered in this webinar or any of our materials. And please, I'm going to hand it over to Jean now. Take time to fill out the feedback form. We will reflect on that, and we will do our best to improve and continue to serve you and give you the training that will help you do your jobs.
Thank you so much. Okay, I've put the instructor or presenter information up on the screen, but I'm going to move on over to the few final reminders we have before we close things out today. So copies of the presentation materials and that whole list of resources, websites, toolkits, guides, charts, other trainings, example reports to look at, those are all available on the seminar resources or links page. You can find that on the middle right of your screen under related URLs. Just click seminar resources and then press the browse to button. If you happen to be watching the recorded version, you can still click that link and have those websites open up on your computer. Contact information for presenters and organizers can also be found on the seminar homepage. It's just another tab that you'll see over there. And please take a minute to fill out that brief online feedback form. The big question I get all the time is, can I have a certificate to get? Can I get CLPs and put this in FATOS, or at least that's how we say it here in headquarters? You absolutely can get a certificate. If you fill out that online feedback form, just make sure you fill out your email address correctly and then check the box at the very bottom of the webinar form that certified you were here for the whole thing. As long as you do that and send in your feedback form, you can then immediately have access to a certificate that you can either print out or save for your own records. For those of you who gather together in a room, you can each fill out that feedback form. So if you weren't the one who registered necessarily, just get the person who did to send you the link to the feedback form, and then you can fill it out on your own. And as noted, today's session was recorded, so you will get an email with information on how you can play it back. And I know that the instructors are also going to work to send an after-course sort of resource packet to everybody, yes, including yes. the trainer manual and other resources that you can use to help deliver this training in your own location. So just stay tuned for follow-up emails from us with more resources and links to the recorded version. So with that, we look forward to reading your feedback, and I want to thank everybody.
Yes.